Broadcasting live from Forward Observer Central Command in Austin, Texas, it's the man always out front on the issues. You're listening to Out Front with Samuel Culver.
Hello and good afternoon and welcome to Out Front with Samuel Culper. I'm your host, Samuel Culper. And I'm coming to you live from Forward Observer Central Command here in Austin, Texas. Well, I've been out of the office for the past 2 weeks, so apologize for the radio silence. I'm so ready to get back to work, back at the helm. So let's get started on today's show. I'm talking about a risk that concerns me. It's not getting enough attention, and it has to do with the U.S. dollar. I've been talking quite a bit about this because this is a change that is likely to be permanent. Once it happens, we're not going back. And what I'm talking about is the possibility or the eventuality that the U.S. dollar is replaced as the world reserve currency over the next decade. Now, who knows when this is going to happen, but it is going to happen eventually. And history shows us, 400 years of history shows us that it could happen within your lifetime, if you're listening to this. But first, I want to thank my Patreon supporters. Thanks for everyone who supports the show through Patreon. I'll be making some changes here in the office. I'm way behind from building out the studio that we had over in the other office, but that will happen. And your monthly support via Patreon is going to help me rebuild out the studio, put foam on the walls, and make the audio quality here much, much higher. Well, I'm starting to see a lot of conservative media outlets talking about the coming coup. And there's an article by Michael Anton. It's entitled The Coming Coup. I think it's over at, I don't know, it's at one of the kind of the new right sites. I think it's like The American Mind, maybe, is where it. By the way, I'm a huge fan. Massive fan of the Claremont Institute. They run the American Mind, and I like a lot of the things that they say, and that's why I give them money to support their efforts as well. Speaking of Michael Anton, I'm reading his book. I'm about halfway through with it. It's called The Stakes. Michael Anton is a guy that called the 2016 election the Flight 93 election. And he says this is another Flight 93 election that's coming up. This Trump-Biden thing. And I tell you, I know I'm not the only person. I'm tired. I'm so tired with every 2 to 4 years being like just an absolutely make or break election cycle for this country. Because eventually it is going to break. There's going to be one party rule. I mean, Joe Biden's already said he's going to do amnesty within the first 100 days. And then we are going to have one party rule. And I think, first of all, I don't carry water for Trump. I think he's a deeply flawed human being. I mean, aren't we all? I kind of grimace and cringe at some of the things he says, some of the tweets he puts out. But I'm supporting the guy because I don't want the alternative. Because basically, I want Trump to win because I'm here locally. I need 4 more years to develop my local human terrain. Like, I need that time before there's no going back. And my concern is that once Biden and the Democrats get in, they're going to make changes and they will build a moat around their political dominance. We're going to have one party rule for who knows how long, generations maybe. And Michael Anton is based in this book, The Stakes. It's a great book. I highly recommend everyone read it or you listen to it or wherever you get your books. It's not, a lot of it is just generally, it's not like stuff you've never heard before. But the way he breaks it down has been very clear. And he really draws the lines. And I'm just getting to the point where he's starting to draw some conclusions. And I'm on like chapter 6 right now. And basically he's talking about, hey, if the current trajectory continues, if current trends continue. And he's written a lot of the same conclusions that I have. And so I'm not sure if we're both victims of groupthink or, hey, maybe we just have it right. I don't know. But I don't like what I see. I don't like what I'm reading in the book as far as the conclusions that he is drawing as well. It's going to be rough sailing. And I've said this many times before, the next decade, I think, is just going to be horrific. Just with all the things that are happening. And on that point, here's one thing that is going to make, or that could make, this next decade very, very difficult. And that starts with this coming coup that's expected to take place sometime between, you know, November to January, take place throughout this time period. I talked about this. I wrote about this for Early Warning subscribers earlier this year. You know, the left is basically bifurcated into liberals and leftists, and both of them are planning a sustained mass mobilization protests, plural, all over the country, in the vein of Tahrir Square or the Euromaidan, and of course, you know, we could see a Lafayette Square type of American Spring. Let me just cover briefly the protest in Cairo at Tahrir Square. They turned into an Egyptian revolution, and they toppled Mubarak from power in 2011. In Kiev, Ukraine, there's this months-long protest and lots of violence. You probably remember seeing this on the TV. I did. I watched it unfold. It's pretty incredible, the scenes that were coming from there. It's like Portland, but on steroids. It's like Hong Kong, but on steroids. And they eventually ousted Yanukovych in 2013. And there's another color revolution going on in Belarus right now, which is aimed at the same thing, removing their leader, Lukashenko, from office right now. They think he's a crook, and they want him gone, and so they're out in the streets. This whole idea of an American Spring, or what could become Lafayette Square, I think they've already attempted this several weeks ago, or you know, a month or however long ago it was. This whole idea kind of began back during the impeachment process. This is when they first tried to actually get something off the ground. This is when they tried to get their color revolution off the ground, because left-wing activists were trying to organize mass mobilization protests that would eventually lead to the toppling of the Trump regime, so they say. And there are lots of articles, like New York Times columnists Michelle Goldberg and Jamel Bowie and Ellie Mistal, who's over at The Nation, and I don't know, a bunch of other people were writing about this American Spring concept, trying to give it some traction, giving this idea some pretty widespread coverage, and they implore the left to mobilize. They said, look, we have to get millions of people out in the streets. That is the only way that we are going to win this impeachment process. And they tried to convince the country that turning out by the millions was an imperative to combating fascism and to demanding the Senate convict President Trump. Now, obviously, that didn't happen. That fizzled about as badly as the Senate trial did. And in hindsight, I think one reason why I remember talking about why we didn't see this, you know, all for like several weeks, you know, probably a month or longer, I was talking about, hey, I was warning people, look, this is what the left's talking about. This is what they're trying to organize. And it fizzled. And in hindsight, I think it fizzled probably because an American Spring was better suited as a course of action saved until the election. Let's target election results with the American Spring, not impeachment, because the Senate's not going to convict this guy anyway. I think that's the line of thinking there. And now today we have, you know, 49 days and some change to go. And we're seeing them. We're seeing the left trying to organize and get this next thing off the ground, which I think undoubtedly is going to happen. The protests that we're seeing now, this thing that just kicked off in Lancaster, PA. By the way, I don't know if you saw the video. This guy's trying to stab a police officer, gets shot and killed in the process, and those people go riot for someone who's trying to kill a cop who got shot in the process. This is not about black lives. This is a warm-up for November. They don't know it yet. But I think what we've seen over the past several months could be a warm-up for November. You know, get everyone all riled up, put some blood in the water, and let them realize, hey, they can go ransack their cities and towns and suffer virtually no repercussions and get a bunch of free stuff in the process. Because you need a new pair of Nikes to go out and riot tomorrow night. Well, any illusion of unity in this country is absolutely gone. Society has tribalized, and this is nothing new. We've been tribalizing for a long time, for decades, at least probably since Obama. I mean, that's like 2000, the financial crisis and the Obama administration. I think those were accelerators in the bifurcation of this country. We have a political system. I mean, you know, you read the presidential polls. Okay, Trump's down by 5, 10, whatever, 40, 60, 50, 50, somewhere in between there, right? That's pretty evenly split. And the economy is also separated between the haves and the have-nots. One thing, and by the way, I've been talking about this for a couple years now, is you look at all the common ground where Americans used to, maybe we didn't see eye to eye, but we were pretty close. And you see how far the left has gone, and there's virtually no overlap anymore. I think a couple of the things that we could agree on, I think government institutions prior to 2016, we could generally all agree that, hey, you know, some government institutions are good. Well, the politicization of the FBI and the Department of Justice and accusations on both sides pretty much railroaded that. You look at the approval rate of Congress, of the Speaker of the House, and government institutions are becoming less and less popular. You know, we used to agree that we all liked football, and now I didn't watch the NFL. I gave up on the NFL a couple of years ago, but I watched college football for like 5 minutes the other night, and they mentioned social justice, and like, oh, this sophomore from Florida State is a social justice leader in his community, and they said that like five times in the 5 minutes that I watched it. And I just had to turn it off. It's absolutely incredible. But we can't even agree on watching football now. That's probably the only 5 minutes of football I'm going to watch this year. The one thing that we can generally all agree on, which is also under threat, there's this. Let me tell you what the one thing is. Ostensibly free and fair elections. I should say actually that was the one thing we could agree on. There's a new poll out just. I think it was published just today, like maybe in the past couple days. 63% of Biden voters don't believe President Trump can win on his own. It was something like 40 or 50% of Trump supporters think that if Biden wins, it's going to be due to a rigged election. So that's like half or over half of supporters in both camps are already will be in disbelief of a free and fair elections. And I'm not here to tell you that we do have free and fair elections. I'm just saying if we have the appearance of free and fair elections, then people are more likely to go out and vote and respect the results. We're talking like 40, 50, I mean, we're talking like tens of millions of people here who are absolutely going to revolt if their side loses because the other side cheated and that's the only way they won. And if we can't agree on free and fair elections, and if we can't all agree that, hey, whoever won was legitimate, then societal, political, and economic conditions are likely to deteriorate. And they could deteriorate quite rapidly. One of the most overlooked threats or results, second-order effects of a failed or contested election is the value of the U.S. dollar. During the ramp-up to the COVID-19 crisis, international investors sought refuge in the dollar and in U.S. markets, especially in the dollar, because that was the safest and highest liquidity place that they could put their store of value. The dollar wasn't going to zero. The dollar was probably not going to lose a lot of value because there's so much demand for it. All these other countries were shutting down, closing their borders. They don't have economies that can prop up their currency. You know who does? The United States. We've enjoyed some pretty incredible benefits of having a society and a political system that supported a relatively stable dollar. I mean, even with massive devaluation, you know, there's that Ron Paul thing, the thing that he talked about, I don't know, a decade ago. The U.S. dollar's lost 97% of its purchasing power since its inception, but in the past 100 years. Like for a 100-year period, the U.S. dollar was inflated away at like 97%. But it's been relatively stable, especially in in the crises of the past several decades. Since the 70s, or since the 70s and 80s, was it 79? There was really high inflation, outrageous inflation. Well, the dollar has historically been a refuge during these times of challenges and crises, and especially international crisis. That's not always going to be the case. I sent an email out 2 or 3 weeks ago about the risks to the dollar, and I got this. I'm not trying to jump on this guy because he actually emailed me back. I just read it this morning. He emailed me back and he said, "Look, I didn't mean it. I didn't mean to be dismissive or condescending, but I read it. It was kind of dismissive and condescending." But he was an accountant, and he replied, and it was kind of condescending. He asked, "Where will international investors put their money if you know?" Basically, he's saying, look, there's nowhere else to put your money. That's why the dollar's not at risk. And I used to think that. I remember being on, I think it was back in March, I was on a podcast on YouTube with Forrest Garvin and PrepperNet. And I said, look, there's not an immediate risk to the U.S. dollar. Well, in the past several months, I've kind of changed my tune because conditions have changed drastically, by the way. There was that J.P. Morgan email, or this J.P. Morgan study, and they found that world reserve currencies last somewhere between 80 and 110 years, meaning that the U.S. dollar could be approaching its historical expiration date, which, if we're going to use the past 400 years of monetary history as a measurement, that 8,200 years is going to occur somewhere between 2024 in 2054. So we may be 4 years away from the death of the U.S. dollar as the world, I shouldn't say death, as the replacement of the world reserve currency. And I think a failed or contested election, especially if we get into some kind of protracted conflict, is going to accelerate this timeline. So this accountant emails me and he says, hey, the U.S. dollar is not at any threat. It's not at any risk of being replaced with the world reserve currency. What's going to replace it? Where are people going to put their money to seek refuge if it's not in the U.S. dollar? And the answer is pretty obvious. The same place they always put their money during times of crisis, even more so with the dollar under duress, and that is gold. We've seen a lot of diversification and interest in cryptocurrency. Globalists have wanted a global reserve, basically a global currency, a worldwide currency for decades. This could very well become their opportunity. They have the IMF issue some kind of stable global reserve currency, and they say, hey, trade us your dollars. We'll basically just absorb this loss just to have the power of running this next global reserve currency. And of course, they all get rich because they can print their own money. They can print their own IMF paper, special drawing rights or whatever, ones and zeros in the bank account. They control it. They can all become fabulously wealthy off of it, because guess who's already put their money in this special drawing rights, the SDR that the IMF could feasibly make or produce. That sounds like a pretty darn good deal for these globalists, by the way. But even if there's not a viable alternative right now, right this second, the world is a big place, I'm telling you. You give these mega investors weeks or months, they're going to find a place to store their cash. Maybe there's no good solution. Maybe there's no great viable alternative to the U.S. dollar. Maybe there's nowhere to hide. Well, the real risk in that case is that international investors are going to be stuck in the U.S. dollar, because no one wants to accept U.S. dollars in these trades. And so what happens to the value of a currency that nobody wants? Right? It's like, oh, here, take my $1 million. Let me buy $1 million worth of this. And they say, no, we don't want dollars. Well, what are you going to do? There's nothing that you can do. So for me, it's kind of serious question time as I look towards the future. If this gets as bad as some people are predicting, I think it could get quite bad. If international demand for the dollar does begin to erode as a result of political, social, and economic instability in this country. By the way, before I get to this point, let me bring this up, because I got an email. I got this email from an economist. Oh, darn it. Hang on. Let me search this out. I thought I had it pulled up already. Oh, here we go. His name is, he gave me permission to read this. His name is Jim Chapelow. He's the barbarian economist. And here's what he had to say. He says, "Hello, I always enjoy your analysis, and you make some important points here. As an economist, I'm not sure that this is necessarily an outlier scenario, though." He continues, "The value of the dollar depends critically on the stability of the U.S. government and its historical position as a global hegemonic power since World War II. Well, since Britain, this is me, since Bretton Woods in 1944, but basically World War II. The barbarian economist continues, "This privileged position has allowed decades of inflation to be effectively exported as long as much of the world is compelled one way or another to use the dollar as a reserve currency for banking and the settlement of international trade." End quote. What he's saying here is, you know, if you're in South Korea and you want to buy wine from Argentina, they're not accepting your South Korean yen or whatever the South Koreans use. You're buying U.S. dollars, and then they're accepting U.S. dollars, sending you the wine, and then, you know, if they're in Argentina, they probably want to keep U.S. dollars. That's illegal, by the way. I think I don't know if it was me or the guy. I was at an airport in Buenos Aires, and I was trying to get rid of my, which way was it? I don't know. One way or the other, I exchanged some money, and I think it was illegal for that guy to have dollars. He's an Argentine citizen. It was when I was down there. It was illegal for them to have U.S. dollars. Why? Because they wanted to prop up demand. They wanted demand for the Argentine peso. And so you couldn't use, if you're a citizen there, you couldn't transact in dollars. You had to transact in Argentine pesos. And so I'm not saying we're going to fall into an Argentine scenario here, but what happens when almost all demand for the U.S. dollar is sapped? I mean, if this does end up happening, we may be facing Argentine-like crisis, Argentine-like financial crisis, monetary crisis. So Jim Chapelow, the barbarian economist, continues, quote, "Over the years, I've seen so many economists, financiers, and pundits make the mistake of crying wolf over the risk of U.S. consumer price inflation due to the federal debt or the inflationary monetary and fiscal policies pursued after each economic downturn, only to be proven wrong as the rest of the world's demand for dollars soaked up this flood of liquidity." End quote. Basically saying, you know, they printed so much money you'd think you'd have massive inflation, but that's not the case because there was enough international demand, and they basically just absorbed all that money that was printed. He continues, quote, "I even made this mistake myself at one point and learned from it. But as we've seen recently, we've had $3+ trillion in fiscal stimulus and another $3+ trillion in Fed monetary injections and no serious consumer price inflation or the collapse of the dollar yet." He continues, "The threat that you suggest, even if the events of the fall election play out the way that they seem to be headed, is a completely different animal. The long-term problems of too much debt and monetary inflation can be staved off only so long as there is a reason for the rest of the world to see the dollar as safe. Hyperinflationary events and currency collapses are almost always triggered by political collapse, revolution, or regime change after a major military defeat. This is the threat to the dollar, and economists who dismiss it based on the track record that a global fight to safety has always saved the dollar in the past are too quick to discount the risk when the internal stability and geopolitical power that made the dollar a safe haven no longer exist. There will be no flight to safety in the dollar." That's what he writes. Basically, he's saying we could be entering a scenario where that historical international demand for the U.S. dollar is simply not there. They seek refuge somewhere else. They put their money in China, put their money in Southeast Asia, put their money in Europe or somewhere else. Or they just start buying up. You know, I can't tell me how many Facebook ads I've seen for art. Buy art. Don't buy gold. Go out and buy some art. or buy some antique car, some sports car. And that's where you put your store of value. I think this is a real risk. And Jim Chapelow, barbarian economist here, seems to... by the way, this is not... I mean, this is not a, like a huge revelation or anything, but I think a lot of people can kind of see the writing on the wall. All I'm trying to do is explain it in the terms that I understand it, and there's the risk, and it's a real risk, and we'll have to see just how bad. I can't tell you right now at this moment in time how bad this, you know, American-made Don type of event is going to be. It could be quite bad. It could last for a long time, which brings me to the next question. It's a serious question. If international demand for the dollar does begin to erode as a result of what's going on in the United States between November and January, or maybe what continues on after January, are the string pullers on the left and the right willing to risk monetary collapse over election results? If the left goes out and they try to pull off an American-made Don, if they try to do some mass mobilization protest, soft coup 2.0, and the markets, U.S. markets crash, and the dollar starts to lose value very rapidly, how much longer will the left push this unrest? How long would the right be willing to hang on to power, even though the financial situation, the monetary situation is collapsing due to this event? Now, I wrote, you know, this may be an outlier scenario, but it is one risk we're going to face over the next 3 to 6 months. And it's a risk that I take seriously. I've started thinking pretty heavily about, okay, how do I get more self-sufficient? By the way, that's been my general conclusion for a long time. Surrounding the election is, look, no matter what happens, the more self-sufficient you are, the better position you're going to be in. The more tribe you build, the deeper and wider you organize your community, the better off you're going to be. That's what I've been pushing. That's what I've been building, trying to build very rapidly, this preparedness network here where I live locally, in this county. So I've been trying to push so many of you to build something similar, to build a network, start networking with other groups, start pulling in lots of groups. I mean, look, there's probably a lot of overlap. Your local Tea Party, or, you know, your local whatever groups, Republican groups, there's probably people there who share the same concerns that you do. Let's rope them in and build an information sharing network. So if this type of stuff does start to happen, we can at least share information. And we'll be much better off as a result. That's not the only risk, of course, but the whole monetary thing, if this does happen to last for more than several weeks, or maybe it lasts for several months or longer, the longer it lasts and the more disruptive it is, the higher the chances that international demand is going to be sapped for the dollar. And, you know, all these $26 or $30 trillion, whatever we end up having in the next year, it doesn't matter exactly. I mean, it matters, but it's just not a pressing thing right now, because the government can keep running up debt because there's this pretty stable international demand for the U.S. dollar. You know, it's like, okay, you sell oranges on your front lawn, and every day you've got this massive line around the block to buy your oranges. And so you say, oh, you know, Will, let's redo the kitchen, honey. Let's redo the bathrooms, and let's build on an addition. And I don't have the money for it, but look, we're selling these oranges so fast. And we could just take the debt out, and we'll just rack up debt. And then you remodel the second addition, and then you build a third story, and you put gold-plated lion statues and a fountain and a whatever, you know, this little cherub that's peeing into the pond or whatever. You put a pool in the backyard, and then you put in a diving board, and you build a tennis court in the back and a basketball court in the back, and you just keep racking up this debt, because, hey man, the orange sales are very good. We keep going, and then all of a sudden someone says, yeah, we kind of depend on these oranges every day. I kind of question the viability of you as an Orange distributing company. And we're real concerned about how much debt you've racked up, or we're real concerned because now you know, for whatever reason, we don't really like being on your front lawn buying these oranges from you anymore, and maybe we're going to go somewhere else. And then you lose a customer here and two customers there and five and 10 customers. And all of a sudden, all your customers start leaving. And guess what? All these great and wonderful projects you've been paying for with debt, you now have to really pay for. And you don't have enough money to pay for it. So where do you turn? You turn to the people who live in your little, in this little mansion here. And you say, hey, it's time to pay up, kids. Well, that's all the government's doing for us. I mean, that's all the government's doing to us. Eventually, they are going to run out of demand for oranges, and then they're going to turn to us and say, "Hey, we got to pay for this pool that we built you. Hey, you, you got to pay for this tennis court that we did." And the kids are like, "Well, Dad, I didn't really want a tennis court. Like, you're kind of going wild there, and I didn't, you know, I don't really care about a pool in the backyard, and I don't care about the angelic little." A gold-plated fountain you built out in the front lawn. Like, I never wanted any part of that. And then Dad says, "Well, that's too darn bad, because you know, I'm your dad and I know what's best, and I made these decisions, and your job is to pay for it. Help the family pay for it." And that's exactly what's going on here. So don't get in the orange business, number one. And two, We've got to figure out what we're going to do. If this scenario happens, we've got to figure out, and eventually it will happen, we've got to figure out what we're going to do. What the heck are we going to do here? In response to the monetary situation that's playing out. Well, I'm past my time. Thanks for listening. By the way, you can go to Patreon. It's patreon.com/, I think it's Outfront Culper. I'll double check that. But if you want to support the show and help me, in my endeavors to get out the good word to people, to talk about intelligence, to talk about current events, the threats that I see out there, and I don't know, maybe an idea or two about how we're going to mitigate these risks, head over to Patreon, kick me a couple bucks a month. It sure would go a long way in helping me to rebuild out this studio in the new office here. Thanks, everyone, so much for listening. Until next time, be well and stay out front. Thank you.